Let's time travel again to a different time.
Another dimension.
Another dimension, another time, another place.
I just want to remind everybody no mountain next week.
Right. No class.
There's no class next week. Oh, because of Thanksgiving. I was like, what's next week? Which Jewish holiday is next week? It is a Jewish holiday. Yes. Here. Sorry, I have all my stuff here. Can move it all. He wants to sit up front. He wants to sit up front. It's fine. Yeah, it's fine. It's fine. So last week we went to we finally made it to the Middle Ages, and that was very exciting for me. We're going to continue into the Middle Ages, and I think I may have mentioned this about this curriculum before. The original title of this curriculum was Dramas of Jewish History, and it does sound like a soap opera, and for good reason. Jewish history is rather dramatic. They changed it to Crossroads, I think, with the idea of being we're looking at different touch points. But at times I feel that this curriculum follows a particular trend in Jewish historiography and just in general the way that we Jews think about history of just going from tragedy to tragedy, right? Right, and it's in a course of this length in terms of the amount of years of material that we're trying to cover, it's really hard to be integrated. So, for example, last week when we read the poem by Eshet Dunash, by Mrs. Dunash, right, we tried to bring in a woman's voice, because otherwise, like, women are delegated to the end of the curriculum. There's like one, right, there's like one lesson on Jewish women as though we only exist in a bubble, right? So I want to honor everything that the course is trying to do and wants me to cover, while at the same time giving a little bit of the idea that it's problematic to just talk about all the bad stuff. And unfortunately, I think we in Pittsburgh in this moment, just having completed the yard site of the terrible attack that happened here, I think we can maybe understand this, at least from speaking for myself, I understand this in a way personally that I did not before. Like when someone comes to Pittsburgh, I want them to know all the good things, right? Like I want them to see this amazing group of people who are all different from one another, represent all these different congregations, different communities, and we come together to learn, right? If someone comes to Pittsburgh, I want them to see the good things and not just as our Federation CEO said in the article that he published, Pittsburgh is not the name of a tragedy, right? Like, and that's the way that term is used. And I feel like when we look at medieval Jewish history, we often have the same, or Jewish history in general, right? Like we just look at all the bad things. We don't get enough time to focus on the good. So unfortunately, today we're going to talk about some really troubling things. But I don't want that to take away from the fact that there were people living the same kind of lives that we live with the same kinds of joys and the same kinds of happiness, right? Like, It would be unfair not to mention the difficult things that our ancestors survived. And I don't remember who said it last week when we were talking about Jews who were coming to Ashkenaz, coming individually, right, of how brave they were, right? Like, I don't want to diminish the incredible bravery and the incredible strength that people exhibited during these times of great distress. But at the same time, you know, We're missing the other half of the story. We're missing the lives of the everyday people who were baking challah and lighting Shabbat candles and having a meal with their family. And we're missing, just all of the everyday things that make up our lives, raising family, children, educating them, hoping that our children will get married. You know, all of the everyday things that we experience, our medieval ancestors experienced too. So I think it's hard, like, as a historian, you almost have to choose one or the other. And so I want to choose both.
As a good example in Pittsburgh, when you talk about that, is the Holocaust Center. Because when Lauren Apter came here, she said, I want this to be a celebration of those who lived through it and the result of their lives and not just showing bones and death and everything else.
And
it's a good way to look at it.
It's so right, and she's such an incredible leader in terms of how she's able to enact history and the kinds of approaches and programs that she brings to the community. She's a treasure. Mm-hmm. I'm really grateful for that because I think it does give us another model and another way to think about things. Yeah.
I'm reading this book by Daniel Gordis, mm-hmm. The Concise History of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently there are a lot of people when Israel was born that they said, we don't have a history. Because up until now, our history has been tragic, and I just want to forget about that. And
right.
Let's start from here. So.
Right. Well, so that's actually, there's a term in historiography that the historians use called the lachrymose view of Jewish history, that like tearful view that we're just going to weep our way through these thousands of years. And that's real. Like I don't want to denigrate those tears, but at the same time, there's also a lot of joy and a lot of happiness, which is why, I mean, honestly, which someone asked me, like, how did I start studying what I studied? That was the reason why I started to study it, is I didn't know anything about the history of Jewish Spain. And here were these, like, happy people writing poems, which to me was a bit of cognitive dissonance when I was 20 years old. But now, right, like, that's my pedagogy. So it's kind of interesting to be in this situation and teach, like, a lot of really, really upsetting stuff. Yes.
I think that I don't know if you said it or if it was the first session, we talked about the fact that we have survived and, mm-hmm. and the fact that all these things, I think it was you, that, you know, we've through all these years, we're still lighting Shabbos candles.
Right.
We're still reading from the Torah. And that kind of sits above everything else that we're learning.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So as we talk about this stuff today, like, keep that in mind, that there were people just like us doing everyday things in spite of this really terrible stuff. So today we're combining two lessons. We're talking about basically the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries, and we're talking about Central Europe, and we're talking about Iberia. So it's sort of interesting when I was thinking about a framework and how to try to relate holding these two different ideas or these two different lessons together. It's almost like when we're talking about anti-Semitism today and we talk about anti-Semitism on the left and anti-Semitism on the right. They have a similar root, but they're manifested in different ways. That's a little bit of the flavor of what we're going to do today. We're going to see different socio-cultural situations in which using the term anti-Semitism is still a bit anachronistic at this time, so we'll see how anti-Jewish sentiment manifested itself in Central Europe and also in Iberia, what is today Spain. So that's the basic goals for today. We're gonna actually read some texts, so if you have your books, and I think for the first time I may have not made enough photocopies for everyone, so you might have to share. But these maps are so detailed that I just wanted to make some copies for everyone. So the maps that I'm going to put on the screen, I have copies of.
I have a different question. Do you have an extra number 10? The last one I have is 9 because I missed the lesson 10.
Oh, I don't have it with me, but I can probably email it to you. I can email you the packet. So this is what I'm passing around is just the same map that's here. On the front is a very short bibliography. I mean, I could give you I could have brought like half my den bookcase to give you books about this. I'm pulling all of these maps from the same book, this Martin Gilbert's Atlas, which I think are great maps. And then in terms of the bibliography, someone made a graphic novel about the last text we're going to study, so be a totally different way to read a history book if you've never done that before. And then three other books that I think are just nice summaries. They're slightly academic, all three of them, but still accessible if any of this sort of piques your interest and you want more.
Which one's the graphic novel?
The first one is the graphic novel, Debating the Truth, the Barcelona Disputation of 1263, and that's what we're going to get to last. And that was published in 2016. We even had an extra packet. Okay. Well done. So when last we left our ancestors of medieval Ashkenaz, they had just begun to settle in the Rhine River Valley of these Shum communities of Speyer, Worms, and Mainz. And as you can see from this, from the first map in your packet, we had a lot of success in terms of finding a way to live in Ashkenaz, create new settlements. Again, the term that we use for how people came to settle there is charters, where basically people got individual permission from whoever the local ruler was, whether that's the bishop, whether that's somebody. But the sort of interesting thing that ends up happening for the Jews of Ashkenaz, and this is true also in Iberia, and in this time I'm really speaking about Jews living under Christian rule, so we're not talking about Jews living under Islam, this is all Jews living in Christendom, is that Jews really end up becoming a very conspicuous minority. Conspicuous for a number of reasons, both because at this time political and ecclesiastical, like church power, is intertwined. So having somebody who's outside of the system, and again, in Christian law, there's no like special category for the Jews. In fact, quite the opposite. This whole notion of replacement theology, where Christians, and this is very blunt, and I don't say this as a way of critiquing any of our friends, family members, our current people that we know in our lives who are Christians, because I think that your average American Christian has no idea about any of this. But at the time, this idea of replacement theology, where Christians really embraced the idea that Christians had access to the right Torah, the best Torah, and that Jews were not only irrelevant, but damaging. So this idea of having someone who's, if you believe that your religion, as the medieval Christians did, that their religion was the only truth, that was the only way to be properly in the world, the only way to achieve eternal life, which was their goal, to have someone who, from their perspective, is blatantly rejecting that notion is very threatening and very unsettling, and does something to affect the stability of their whole Weltanschauung, of their whole worldview. So it ends up being really problematic for the Jews, because on the one hand, and I'm going to say we as though we're living back then, on the one hand, because we're functioning slightly outside of the system, we could fill necessary roles in society, right? Like if there is a job, let's say money lending, from which Christians are prohibited to do for one another, and we're traders and we carry all of our wealth and movable property and we can be money lenders, well, that's great for us. So we're actually kind of doing everybody a favor by stepping into that role. But then at the same time, if the reason why that's outlawed in Christian society is because it's evil and wicked and sinful, then like, okay, we've got these people here who are evil, wicked, and sinful. You can end up seeing how it's problematic. So I just wanted to give you an idea of how far Jews had spread during this relatively short period of time, which I think shows that on the one hand, while Christianity was willing to accept Jews, we were accepted in a kind of subjugated way. We were still able to find success and still able to move around. There's a very deeply complicated background to the emergence of the Crusades as a phenomenon in history. Like, why did the Crusades happen? Well, in addition to this whole battle with like the internal minority of Jews who are living in Christian lands, the Christian battle with Islam emerges as an ideological force that drives society. The idea being that with the advent of Islam, as Islam swept through the Holy Land, which at this point Christians are also taking ownership of Jerusalem and of all these holy spaces in the land of Israel, there also becomes something threatening to the fact that Christians no longer have political dominion in the land that is central to their theology. And that ends up becoming a driving force. And again, there are a lot of reasons, there's a lot of complicated reasons as to why the Crusades emerge. The original historiographical approach to Jewish history is that, and I'm just going to be very blunt, and I don't mean it to sound callous, but that as the Christian religious leaders, as they gathered people to go on crusade, the crusaders, as they swept through Europe to the east, would kill Jews as they went along. Because they said, oh, we're killing infidels, we're going to take the Holy Land back from infidels, we're just going to destroy communities as we go because these are also infidels who are also rejecting the truth of our religion. Yes?
There was a talk several years ago in the Pittsburgh Family Psychology Center about the first crusades, the Jews, and Bone and Family Theory. They didn't just kill Jews, it erased their debt and they took all their funds. I mean, so it funded the crusades.
Exactly. Which is, again, is a repeated, I mean, that's what happened with the expulsion from Spain. Anytime that this happened with expulsions also throughout this period, if a ruler had made a charter, sorry, Sharon, you sit next to me, so you're always my person. So you can be the Jewish person this time. So I'm the ruler. I make a charter with you. You loan me a bunch of money as part of your thing, and I'm supposed to pay you back. I can't pay you back. Oh, all of a sudden, all the Jews are expelled from my kingdom. Your charter is null and void, which was another way of essentially raising funds and making money. So yes, the economic impact of killing Jewish, doing away with Jewish communities and Jewish individuals as the Crusaders traveled through Europe can't be ignored. And also just general pillaging of like taking whatever the Jews had to fund their trip as they went. Yeah, Art.
I don't recall his name, but the Pope that called for the First Crusade was having political problems with the Holy Roman Empire and the Emperor. And to buttress his political position, he called for the First Crusade to kind of take charge of what was going on.
Exactly.
So he launched this whole thing.
Exactly. So that actually, we have a text from this Pope, Pope Urban, in our reader. It's the first text in lesson 12. It's kind of long. I don't know if it's worth reading the whole thing.
So it had nothing to do with the fact that the Christians had the feeling that the Jews had killed Jesus.
That was part of it. That was part of it. But the Crusades were not against the Jews, to be clear. The Crusades were ostensibly about taking the Holy Land back from the Muslims, from the infidels, right? So look, if we had had, you know, sovereignty at that time, I'm sure we would have been dragged into it. Let's see. I'm trying to see if there's something I can pull out from this text. Yeah.
I have a short section that begins on 126 and continues from the bottom of 126 to 127.
Okay. Do you want to read it?
Well, if it's in line with what you were going to argue, I think it is.
Yeah, I mean, the two things that I mean, there's a lot that could be pulled out of this text, but there's proof text for Art about how the inner Christian working between the Western Christian kingdoms and the Byzantine Holy Roman Empire, and then also how the Jews got swept up into it.
Okay, so if you want to turn to the bottom of page 126, line starting on line 47, page 126, "For your brethren who live in the East," this is Urban II, "for your brethren who live in the East and are in urgent need of your help, and you must hasten to give it to them, to give them the aid which has often been promised them. For as the most of you have heard, the Turks and Arabs have attacked them and have conquered the territory of the Greek Empire, as far west as the shore of the Mediterranean and the Hellespont, which is called the Arm of St. George. They have occupied more and more of the lands of those Christians and have overcome them in seven battles. They've killed and captured many and have destroyed the churches and devastated the empire. If you permit them to continue thus for a while with impurity, the faithful of God will be much more widely attacked by them. On this account, I, or rather the Lord, beseech you as Christ's herald to publish this everywhere and to persuade all people of whatever rank, foot soldiers and knights, poor and rich, to to carry aid promptly to those Christians and to destroy the vile race from the lands of our friends. I say this to those who are present. It is meant also for those who are absent. Moreover, Christ commands it.
Wow.
All who die, and one more sentence.
Yeah.
All who die by the way, whether by land or by sea, or in battle against the pagans, shall have immediate remission of sins.
Incentivization.
Yeah, so if you think about it, you know, these families that had more children than they could possibly pass on lands or wealth to, like, this is great. You send them off, you know. So what's interesting is I think we often have the idea that ideas about race were socially constructed in modernity, but you can see that race as a social construction, or race as this kind of ideological force to divide people and to pit people against each other, it's already happening in the medieval period. Yeah, Mimi.
I have a word question, and at about line 56, if you permit them to continue thus for a while with impurity, did they mean impunity?
I don't know, because I don't have the Latin.
Because impunity makes more sense.
Yeah.
Impunity makes more sense.
Yeah.
I think it's a typo.
Yeah.
I mean, but there is also the idea of desecration, which may be why the person mistranslated why the typo, that, like, you know, if the Muslims are coming in and taking these churches and turning them into a mosque, or, you know, or worse, right? Like, there were also times when the religion, and the Christians did this too, so I'm trying to, like, where the overtaking religion would take the holy places of the people they were trying to displace and then turn it into, like, a barn, right? Mm-hmm. So then there's, like, cow, right? Like, yeah. So that's one thing that's happening. I want to try to juxtapose. I want to try to be in two places at once. So the reason why the Crusades happen sort of in Central Europe, as we would think about it, and go east, why didn't the Crusades have anything to do with Spain? Why were there no Crusaders really going from Spain to the Holy Land? Why was that not a thing? Because the thing was that here in Iberia, in Spain, we have our own homegrown crusade, which is called the Reconquest, La Reconquista. And we spoke about this last week, that when the Muslims came through North Africa and conquered all of Iberia in the year 711, there was an immediate response by the Christian kingdoms of getting the land back, and the Reconquest started in that moment. Like, the second that the conquest happened, the Reconquest happened. So if you look at the exact same time, like if we look at the year 1096 in Iberia, what's happening there? The Christian kingdoms are fighting on their own fronts, trying to expel Muslim rulers and Muslim power from Iberia, and also take all of that land back. So by 1096, more than half of Iberia is already back under Christian control. And again, we Jewish communities found ourselves hustling. I don't know how else to describe it, where, you know, apparently one of my colleagues has done all this research that Jews were actually knighted, like made knights, during the 11th century by the Castilian kings in Spain, because once you were knighted, you could get a land grant, and they would basically send the Jews out to live on what was then the frontier to hold land. To hold land for the Christians. And as Jewish people, we had been denied land owning, since Roman times. It was very exciting to own land. Unless you think that this is not connected to anything happening today, there are descendants of people who were expelled from Spain or forcibly converted that we call Anusim, or B'nai Anusim in Hebrew, who still hold the keys to their families, fincas, to their families' land estates in Castile, essentially. So if any of your kids or grandkids want to dress up as knights for Purim, it's totally historically accurate to be a Jewish knight. Just wanted to put that one out there.
I knew a fellow whose last name was Valentine, who traced his roots back to Valencia. And
amazing.
One of those knighthoods you were talking about.
Wow. Yeah, it's really, so there was no mass, again, I'm like, I say it like, and it just sounds so blunt in my head. There was no mass slaughter of Jews in Iberia because the Jews were able to participate in this idea of reconquest in a different way than the Jews in Ashkenaz, who were basically, there are terrible chronicles. They're called the Crusade Chronicles. And on the bibliography that I gave you, the second book, God, Humanity, and History, the Hebrew First Crusade Chronicles, Bob Chazen, who's a historian at NYU, has translated them and analyzed them that you can read. I mean, incredibly, incredibly heartbreaking stuff. Some of it is really enough to turn your stomach. So I kind of prefer not to read it together because I think it's too much personally.
It's in our text.
There's some in our text that's really upsetting that I think you can read. You have enough historical background now that you could read it about what happened when the Crusaders came through these various communities. We can look at text 4, which is basically as the Crusaders came through, the Jews and the Jewish communities, sometimes on an individual basis and sometimes on a communal basis, were presented with two options, convert or die. And the Jews of Ashkenaz, being pious in the way that they were, some of them chose to sacrifice themselves to, we don't even really use the term commit suicide. They chose to end their own lives, al kiddush Hashem, to sanctify God's name, rather than be converted or be murdered. Their idea being, they can't kill. They can't kill the people who are coming. If they felt that they could have defended themselves, they would have. So instead, they choose to end their own lives. If we want to look at text 4, so again, this happened, these waves of communal executions, of communal self-sacrifice, of individual murder happened with each subsequent wave of the Crusades, right? Like as each new Crusade came on the scene, more would happen. And some of these, obviously, if a whole community was sacrificed or sacrificed themselves and no one lived to tell, some of these are secondhand or third-hand accounts that were written down later. So the historicity in some cases may not be an eyewitness account. It may be a poetic understanding of what happened. Some of them, written in subsequent years. It's not like there was a reporter there who could necessarily take down everything that happened. Anyways, let's read this from text 4. Someone want to read?
The errant ones and the burghers now departed from there and entered the city, and they came to a certain courtyard where David the Gabbai, son of Nathaniel, was hiding together with his wife, children, and his entire household. The courtyard of a certain priest. The priest said to him, "Behold, not a vestige or remnant has survived in the bishop's courtyard or the count's. They have all been slain, cast away, and trampled underfoot in the streets, except for a few who were profaned. Do as they did so that you may be saved, you, your money, and your entire household from the errant one."
Okay, pause for a minute. So basically, this is a story about a family who are hiding. A priest is hiding them, but the priest says, look, everyone else has been murdered or being profaned. He means that they converted to Christianity. So he says, just convert. Convert with me right now. I'll convert you to save you. Do you want to keep going? Thank you.
The God-fearing man replied, "Go to the errant ones and to the burghers and tell them all to come to me." When the priest heard the words of Master David the Gabbai, he rejoiced greatly, for he thought, "Such a distinguished Jew has consented to give heed to our words." He ran to them and related the words of the righteous man. They, too, rejoiced greatly and gathered about the house by the thousands and myriads. When the righteous man saw them, he placed his trust in his Creator and called out to them, saying, "Alas, you are children of whoredom, believing as you do in one born of whoredom. As for me, I believe in the eternally living God who dwells in the lofty heavens. In him have I trusted to this day, and in him I will trust until my soul departs. If you slay me, my soul will abide in the Garden of Eden and the light of life. You, however, descend to the deep pit, to eternal obloquy, condemned together with your deity, the son of promiscuity, the crucified one." Upon hearing the words of the pious man, they flew into a rage. They raised their banners and encamped around the house and began to cry out and shout in the name of the crucified one. They advanced toward him and slew him, his pious wife, his sons, his son-in-law, and his entire household and kin. All of them were slain there in sanctification of the name. There the righteous man fell together with the members of his household.
A lot of the other texts talk about mothers and children and babies, and that's why I'm choosing not to read them. I think they're very, very disturbing. A historical note to be your footnote provider. This whole thing about son of whoredom, that's how, that's the Jewish understanding of Mary. The Jewish understanding of Mary is that she was a prostitute and that that's why she was pregnant before she got married to Joseph. And that's like, there are all kinds of other medieval texts about Jesus. Actually, there is a whole genre called Toldot Yeshu, the histories of the life of Jesus. And in those stories, there's stories about Jesus's life. They're, you know, completely apocryphal, but they're handed down in like a Jewish kind of midrashic way. And in all of those stories, Mary's a hairdresser, which apparently in the medieval period was like a kinui, was a code word for prostitute. So you can imagine that that was also something very inflammatory to Christians to think that this is what the Jewish community thought about their God. So I think in your book, I think there are some pictures. Do you have some pictures? No? No pictures? Oh. If you go, are they in the next?
Next chapter?
Okay. Statues. Yeah. Okay, we've got some statues.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
147.
So this is actually statuary that is on one of the entrances of Notre Dame in Paris. I wonder if it's burned. I wonder if this was in the part that burned or if this is in the part that remains. And these are two sisters, and one is called Ecclesia, which is the church. And the other is synagoga. And Ecclesia is crowned, has the scepter of rule of law with a cross on top, has the cup representing not kiddush, not our kiddush, representing the sacrament of taking communion of Christ's blood. And her sister, synagoga, let's look at synagoga. She is blindfolded. She's in a posture of kind of submission. Her holy book is held down, is hidden away. And this is the iconography that expresses the Christian values around having Jews as a part of their community, where they're two sisters, they're understood to be connected to one another. I mean, they're equally beautiful, but synagoga is the disrespected, wrong older sister, and Ecclesia is the younger, triumphant, ruling sister. And the thing that's kind of messed up is that this exact paradigm comes to us from the Torah, right? Where Esav is the older brother and Yaakov gets his birthright. This is Cain and Hevel, where Cain does what he's not supposed to do, and you know, Hevel was right. Like this is a paradigm that comes down from the scriptures and is interpreted in a very particular way in the Christian community. And this kind of iconography, once you start to look for it, next time you're on your European vacation, you'll see this constantly. Because also keep in mind that the Christian population was not highly literate, so this was a text that the average Christian could read. This was something that was understood, that this was us, the Christians. This was them, the Jews. That was yes, Mimi.
What's the object
behind
synagogue's head? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The same thing.
I think.
Looks like an axe, but.
Yeah, I can't tell. It might be an axe.
Looks like an arrow.
Yeah. Looks like a spear.
It's a spear. What, you think it's a spear?
Yeah.
Oh,
that's bad.
Is it in her head?
Yeah, it's a broken. It's a broken spear. It's a broken spear.
Okay.
I looked at my notes. Ah, look, she was holding it. Look, you can kind of see. There's the bottom part of the spear,
oh, yeah.
And there's the top part of the
yeah,
spear.
It
so it was, yeah. It was a weapon, but now it's broken. She has no power. She has no political power. Yeah.
If you wanted to see more of this, what's the word used? Iconography in mm-hmm. this sense. How would I find that? The specific.
There are a couple of books. If you wanted to look at like a book that has all the pictures all around.
Where,
yeah, it's juxtaposed. Yeah.
It's juxtaposition. I'd be interested in that for my
yeah.
daughter. Actually.
Yeah, I'll look that up and I can send that. I can send that to
thank
everyone.
You.
The other the other thing I was just saying, I was thinking about how today in Israel we have this kind of there's an image that's often put forth like in Birthright marketing materials or in other Israel marketing materials of the young IDF soldier like looking so vibrant and healthy with the gun. And I think as Americans, like because we have our issues that we have with guns, like it's almost a direct response to this. Like in a deeply, like in a such a deeply cultural way that like this was us or what other people told us about ourselves for all those years. Now we're gonna tell a different story.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're gonna tell a different story. So these images, I think if you
there
keep going,
one,
yeah.
One,
sorry, I should have made.
For 2 seconds.
Yeah.
In your story about the Birthright and the IDF, who is the synagogue? Who is the?
There is no one. It's just a reimagining. Yeah, it's just an iconographic response saying that we.
The Jew.
Yeah, because I'm.
Yeah,
where I'm going.
I know where you're going with that exactly. Usually in these kind of materials, there's no juxtaposition. It's just us, which I think is also kind of an interesting
yes.
idea that we were always juxtaposed. Now let us tell our own story. It's just us in the frame. There is no juxtaposition. There are problems with that too, but you can see where it emerges from, almost from an art theory perspective.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I should have made color copies. I assumed it would be color in your book.
154 at the bottom is the one on the.
Is this one?
No.
No, it's this one.
Yeah.
Yes.
So what's also interesting is that if we start to look at Christian texts that were just for Christians, because here's the thing, if it's on the cathedral, we're going to see it when we're walking by too. The Jewish community is going to see it. The things that are just in manuscripts are really only for Christian consumption. They're, and for the elite Christian consumption, not everybody had access to these kind of illuminated manuscripts. And you can see that the Jewish people are represented here as like kind of creatures, like non-human creatures, which I think, and again, when we start talking about these kind of social constructions of race and how racial theory starts to emerge and how people are divided, this is another reason why we have the lachrymose view of Jewish history, is because historians, and Chazen talks about that in another book that I recommended to you, people look at, God forbid, the 20th century and say, how could the Holocaust happen? And the historians say, well, here's your root of it. This is a dehumanization of Jewish people in propaganda the same way that Hitler did, and that it emerges out of this kind of Christian theological racialism where their moral depravity of rejecting Jesus is reflected in some kind of racial...
Look at the noses.
I know. It's really something. It's really something.
Well,
and this is where the Christ killer stuff does come up.
Well, they're grabbing at Jesus.
Right. Right, they're going to give him over to Pontius Pilate. Yeah.
I don't know if the root of all this was being the Christ killer, but even such, without it, the fact that we had our own religion, our own, that we refused to conform is enough
right.
to say evil.
Right, right.
You said that you were sorry it was in color in our book. Are the colors, do the colors have a significance? Other than the grayish.
If Jesus was more, sometimes blue has a significance, like that the blue is like the holiness, and that's also from the Torah, actually, yeah. about Tchelet. So sometimes you will see blue as more of a color. Blue, I think, is a color that's very much associated with Mary, and that there's some kind of holiness with the of the First Crusade. Just to give you an idea, so you see the Shum communities, the Jewish communities, were like, on the route for many of the crusaders. Just one other thing I just wanted to make sure that I mentioned. Yeah.
Jewish communities were Metz, Trier, and Elier?
The very famous, I mean, there were also Jews in Metz, but the famous Speyer, communities Worms, were Speyer, Worms, and Mainz, the Shum communities.
Okay.
What is Shum? That was from last week. It's just an acrostic of Shin, Vav, Mem, just the first letter of Speyer, Worms, and Mainz, because they were all in the Rhine River Valley.
Okay.
So that's just, if you see that, that's what that's referring to, because the circumstances of their establishment and the kind of lives that the people lived there were all very similar, so that's why they're kind of grouped together. Because they had a lot in common. So shifting gears a little bit, but related somewhat to this whole idea of ecclesia and synagoga in juxtaposition, another phenomenon that happens in the medieval period is the public disputation. The public disputation becomes a way of publicly performing theological subjugation of Jewish people, where the local Jewish person, leader, scholar, whoever was known like to be the smartest Jew, would be called into the town square, often with the presence of political and religious leadership, and asked to defend Judaism. And here's the thing that like really kind of turns the stomach. Often the Christian disputant was someone who had converted from Judaism to Christianity and then entered the cloth. So the interesting thing that happens is that in these public disputations, it ends up being a discussion of the Talmud, where the Christian priest or whoever it is, the Christian disputant attempts to use Jewish text against a Jewish disputant.
Is this a rabbi at this time? Okay.
Yeah, a rabbi. So you can see in your next map, there were many of these public disputations. And one of the most famous ones for our purposes happened in the year, this is too small on the screen. Happened in the year 1263 in Barcelona. And what's special about this public dispute is that we have both sides of the story. We have the Christian text that says I won, and we have the Jewish text that says I won. Mm-hmm. But the Jewish disputant was thrown out of the crown of Aragon. So clearly the Christian ecclesiastical power won. So this is I'll pass around. This is what I'd mentioned, that there's a graphic novel about this, because we have both sides, and this is another one that I think they did make into a movie sometime in the 70s or 80s. I couldn't find a good clip for us on YouTube. It's a little ridiculous. And there's also a clip about this from that Israeli show, The Jews Are Coming, But I didn't have time to give it my own subtitles, and they don't have one that was subtitled in English. So I could work on that in like my free time and send it to you because it's very cinematic. Like, because we have both sides of the story that like they're in the town square, the king is there, they're disputing, everyone's watching. They both go home and write the story, and they both say, "I won." And this is definitely a case where the rabbi was disputing someone called Pablo Cristiani, who had been born Jewish, raised Jewish, and converted to Christianity. Yes?
Did the Jews ever win?
No. I mean, it's like, no. Of course not.
It was a show.
It was a show. It was the we're beating the Jews show, so the Jew can never win.
Right.
Yeah, yes.
What happened at the end?
Sometimes the disputant, the rabbi, was imprisoned. Sometimes the community was punished. Sometimes people were thrown out. In this case, he was expelled from the crown of Aragon. So this is in Barcelona in the year 1263, which at that time was called the crown of Aragon. It was the capital. Yes.
If they always lost, why would they agree to participate?
Because what else are you going to do? They're going to come and kill you or kick you out anyway. So you might as well try to prove your case.
I just assumed that they were killed after.
Not always. In this case, so let me tell you. So the name of the rabbi who participated in the public disputation in Barcelona in 1263 is Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman. So I always say this, that the rabbis have these names that are acronyms based on the first letter of their name. And the joke in the Jews Are Coming sketch, and the joke for many people, is that Ramban lived in the 1200s, so that is the 13th century, and lived in what is today Catalonia, in the crown of Aragon. Maimonides, we call him Maimonides, like using a Greek formulation of his name, was a guy named Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon Rambam. It's really confusing because they all just, like, if you don't already know them, like, they're your best friends in a way that I sometimes feel I do. It can be very confusing. Yeah. So a lot of people would say, like, oh, Maimonides disputed in 1263. No, that was Nachmanides, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman. I put, this is Maimonides. This is his Arabic name because we also know him from Arabic sources, Musa ibn Maimun. So it's all the same thing.
And when did he live?
He lived in the 1100s, okay. Right? So like 100 years prior. Was born in Cordoba in the south of Spain, but then lived in Fostat, the Jewish suburb of Cairo, which is just to the north of Cairo. So you'll see Maimonides, Moshe ben Maimon, Musa ibn Maimon, has basically the same name in Hebrew or in Arabic. Like in his two cultural contexts, he had the same name. In Christian Spain, you know, again, this is like multiple kingdoms, so saying Christian Spain is like is totally anachronistic. They spoke Romance languages that were like in between Latin and what came to be Catalan, and their names for themselves, like outside of the Jewish community, were totally different. So I think about it like my name is Danielle, but my Hebrew name is Esther, right? Like they're totally, like they have nothing to do with each other. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the Jewish community. In Iberia, they often, their name that they would use in the Christian world or when they were outside the Jewish community often had nothing to do with their Hebrew name, their Jewish name. So his name is Bonasruk da Porta. And I just tell you this because if you're ever walking around in Catalonia, there are many streets with that name. I don't remember, I was in Girona, which happened to be his hometown just outside of Barcelona. We just went to some tapas bar and it was on the street, Bonastruc de Porta, and I was just cracking up. I was like, I'm on Nachmanides Street and we're just going to drink some like cider and have some, you know, and have some egg omelet. And it just felt like incredibly incongruous to me because to me that's like, I don't know. It's like it's very special, right? Like we would notice if we were walking down a street somewhere and it said Ben Gurion or it said, right? Like we would notice. But because their names, it doesn't say like Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman Street, right? It used his Catalan name.
Just talking about names, the opponent in this debate in Barcelona was Pablo Cristiano.
Yes.
So whenever I come across the name Cristiano, I think about the people who were forced or chose to convert during this period. They were first Jews and then they became Christians. Is that a correct supposition that people who carry the name Cristiano to this day probably have roots in this converso period?
Some might. I don't know if we can make an across the board kind of designation in that way, but yes, many of these Jewish people who converted to Christianity, like Pablo, we were talking about Paul, right? Paul being who Paul was in the Jewish world. Like if he's going to convert and show his devotion and show what a real Christian he is, he picked like the most blinged out Christian name he could possibly find. I have a friend who's actually a rabbi, who chose to re-become Jewish. His ancestors were Jewish from Sicily. His last name is DeJesu, of Jesus. So his ancestors, when they converted the same way, like they were going to show their fervor that they were Jesus's, and that was their name. So Rabbi DeJesu, he lives today in Jerusalem, happens to be the main translator of Hebrew contemporary literature into Italian. So if you ever read a Hebrew novel translated into Italian, my friend Antonio is the one who translated it. Like he knows like 20 languages. He's like one of the smartest people I've ever met. We're at JTS the same time with Rabbi Adelson. So Rabbi Adelson knows him too. So I just photocopied one page of the graphic novelization of the disputation, just because I like thinking about the visual, and it happens to show, right, that this is Pablo Cristiani and this is our friend Bonastruk. That means a good star, by the way. It's almost like his name was like Mazel Tov in Catalan. The Ramban, they're arguing about an Agadah, right? They're arguing about internal Jewish texts. He's not bringing the Greek scriptures or the Hebrew scriptures. They're talking about rabbinic texts, which is so interesting. So we obviously, you can see if you look at your map, we have these other kind of public disputations. But again, this is sort of the most famous one because of the fact that we have both accounts.
Quick question for you?
Yeah.
Who attended the disputations? Just the committed or the Jews, and did they divide? Because it's very strategic to have the debate the way it was framed with a converted and a rabbi.
Exactly. It seems like these were probably only attended by Christians because the mobs would be incited to violence or whatever. Like the Jewish people were not going to come and have stuff thrown at them. So this particular debate was conducted with the king present, the king of the crown of Aragon at the time. So if there were Jews who were a part of the court, which was a thing in Iberia, that there were often Jews who were part of the king's court, like we were talking about the knights, right? That perhaps they would be in attendance. But in terms of who was present in the town square, it was for a Christian audience. That this was public theological subjugation of the Jews for the Christians. Like the Jews would stay away.
Okay. I may have missed this, but do we have a transcript of the actual?
Well, it's not, I mean, again, there's no journalist. This is why if we had a time machine, it'd be really cool. They both went home and wrote down what happened.
Okay.
And they both say they won.
Okay.
So
we have two points of view.
We have two points of view, which is why we have this, you know, why this was a good one for a graphic novel, why I think it would be a great for a contemporary film, just because when you have both perspectives, it's a richer view of what may have actually happened. Because
not really. Look at the impeachment hearing. Two points of view and you don't know what the hell's going on.
Touche.
Wow.
Yeah, touche.
Or a Trump rally.
That would be
the disputation. Yeah.
Yeah. No, there's only one point of view there.
But that's oh, you're right. But I'm talking about who attends.
So I don't know if we want to read just a little bit from the disputation text. just to get a flavor for it. And we do have it in the original Hebrew, which is great for those of us who know Hebrew. It's really special to have this kind of text that, while it is theological or holy in some way as he's citing rabbinic sources, it's also a social and cultural source of, like, what was he doing? Someone want to read? So we're in lesson 13, text 3.
Oh, so there's two accounts.
Right.
Oh, yeah, that, this
what
is
page is that?
Rabbi, it's 148.
Does anybody want to read?
Our Lord the King commanded me to hold a disputation with Fray Paul in his palace, in his presence, and in the presence of his counselors in Barcelona. I replied, I will do as my Lord the King commands, if he will give me permission to speak as I wish. I was seeking thereby the permission of the King and the permission of Fray Ramon of Penaforte and his associates who were there. Fray Ramon of Penaforte replied, provided only that you do not speak disrespectfully. I said to them, I do not wish to have to submit to your judgment on that, but to speak as I wish on the matter under dispute, just as you say all that you wish. And I have enough understanding to speak with moderation on the matters of dispute, just as you do. But let it be according to my own discretion. So they all gave me permission to speak freely.
Okay, pause for a second. Do we really think, I mean, this is my question too, that he had the chutzpah to say to the king, well, I'll only do it if you let me say what I want. Like,
not gonna happen.
I mean, I understand. It is true that the community in Girona was well established. It is true that he was respected in his time. And I mean, the fact that they didn't kill him does show that he had some kind of gravitas or authority in himself. But can you imagine that he's really going to say to the king, I need carte blanche if I'm going to be present. Otherwise, I'm not coming. So this is Nachmanides, see, even I do it. This is Nachmanides going home after the dispute and writing down everything that happened.
Oh, okay.
And then the same thing, Pablo Cristiani goes home and writes down his account of what happened.
And we just found it.
They were, luckily, yeah. If you imagine all the stuff that we didn't have handed down to us, this was something that was preserved.
Upon this, I replied, there is dispute between Gentiles and Jews on many points of religious practice in the two religions, which are not essential for religious belief. In this honored court, I wish to dispute only on matters which are fundamental to the argument. They all replied, you have spoken well, and thus we agreed to speak on the subject of the Messiah, whether he has already come, as Christians believe, or whether he has yet to come, as Jews believe. And after that, we would speak on whether the Messiah was truly divine or entirely human, born from a man and a woman. And after that, we will discuss whether the Jews still possess the true law or whether the Christians practice it. Then Fray Ramon of Penaforte rose up and preached about the Trinity, and he said that it consisted of wisdom, will, and power. And he said in the synagogue, the maestro too in Girona agreed in this matter to the words of Fray Paul. I stood on my feet and said, hearken and listen to my voice, Jews and Gentiles. Fray Paul asked me in Girona whether I believed in the Trinity. I said, what is the Trinity? Does it mean that the deity has three physical bodies such as that of human beings? Said he, no. Does it mean then that the deity has three refined entities, such as souls or angelic beings? Said he, no. Does it mean one entity derived from three as bodies are derived from the four elements? Said he, no. If so, what is the Trinity? Said he, wisdom, will, and power.
Okay, pause there for 1 second. So I just want to say something else about what the purpose of this text might have been and why we still even have it. Clearly, the reason why he wrote this down afterwards and why he wrote it down in Hebrew is because he wanted to give to the Jewish community and the Jewish leaders answers that they could make to the Christians when people engage them in discussion on these kinds of questions, yeah. Right? So for him, this is a pedagogical text. It is kind of a Jewish propaganda text because he has enough authority within the Jewish world to say, I'm going to write this down and I'm going to get it disseminated to the extent that I can, because Jews all over Christendom are being brought these kinds of questions to them. So I'm going to give them something, either to be a personal comfort or to be something that they could actually use in this kind of situation where these major issues like the Trinity, right? Because monotheism, that was our thing. That's our whole thing, ultimately, right? So to deal with the Trinity is a huge issue in the Jewish perspective. And you can imagine, like, to the Jewish people, seeing all, it looked like statue worship, right? It looked like what we exactly believe our ancestor Abraham was fighting against. So that's probably the reason why this text was preserved, is because it was useful. It was actually something that had a practical application for what it is. Okay, we're way over time. So, anyways, you can keep going. You can read it on your own.